This is the Climate Report, episode 25, originally recorded on December 10th, 2018. The Climate Report is an examination of the issues, especially the political issues, that are necessary to address and be aware of so that we might solve the climate crisis, which is one of the most important and gravest situations that we as humans face. And it's the purpose of this show is to talk about it so we can think about it so that we can take appropriate action. Why do we have a climate crisis to begin with? Well, we could say it's because of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and we drive too much, et cetera, et cetera. But we, in order to properly understand the problem and its solutions, we need to look at the political and economic system that we find ourselves in. And we should have the freedom and the liberty to think about the system that we're in. We should have the freedom and the liberty to critique the system that we're in. For example, in America today, it is considered radical to critique capitalism. If you call into question the basic soundness of our capitalist system, then you're a socialist and you're on the fringe and you're radical and you're somebody to be marginalized. But on the Climate Report, and a growing number of people in America, especially young people, see the faults of unfettered capitalism and the lies that it's based upon. So we're okay with critiquing the system. And as part of critiquing the system, we look at current events and issues. As I speak, recently, President George H.W. Bush passed away. And so we're going to take a little bit of time to read one of his speeches to see, you know, what kind of person was he? But more importantly, what kind of system is he speaking for? So let's go back to March 6th, 1991. This is an address before a joint session of Congress on the end of the Gulf War. In a previous episode, we commented on the first few minutes of the speech, and now we're continuing with that. So, quoting the speech, "Tonight in Iraq," this is George H.W. Bush speaking to a joint session of Congress, "tonight in Iraq, Saddam walks amidst ruin. His war machine is crushed. His ability to threaten mass destruction is itself destroyed. His people have been lied to, denied the truth. And when his defeated legions come home, all Iraqis will see and feel the havoc he has wrought." Now, he says, "Tonight in Iraq, Saddam walks amidst ruin." Okay, it's as if this one bad guy is walking amidst ruin. Never mind that 100,000 Iraqis have been killed and many families have lost loved ones. We have depleted uranium being spread with bombs so that people are walking amidst radioactive chemical warfare. But he's trying to isolate Saddam as if this one bad guy walks amidst ruin. And he says, his war machine is crushed. Well, a lot of Iraqis' lives are crushed. His ability to threaten mass destruction is itself destroyed. Never mind our ability to threaten mass destruction. If you want to know, I'm talking about the United States, if you want to know a country that threatens mass destruction on a daily basis, then it's the United States. And I don't hate my country. I love my country. That's why I expect better of my country. We need to dispense with this ethic that says if you want to be pro-American, that means waving the flag and that means being militaristic. How about if being pro-American means loving the people of America and wanting better of our foreign policy? If you love the people of America, then you're not going to support wars that we have to pay for, but that only benefit the shareholders of companies that profit from war. The shareholders of Boeing, the shareholders of Bechtel, the shareholders of Halliburton, the shareholders of GE. War profits wealthy investors, but it is us, the average taxpayers, who pay for war with our tax dollars. We pay, and people abroad who are at the wrong end of a gun pay for war with their lives, with their homes, with their communities, etc. Continuing with the speech, Bush Sr. says, his people, talking about Saddam, his people have been lied to, denied the truth. Okay, this is a man who just, you know, this, the Iraq War, the first Iraq War, was 6 weeks long. Americans were divided about 50-50 as to whether we were going to go to war. And then there was a young Kuwaiti woman who testified before Congress and read a prepared statement, and she was a good actor. She was all emotional. And she told a biggest lie about Iraqi soldiers going into a hospital, taking the incubators and leaving babies to die on the floor. And that got Americans riled up to where we wanted to go to war against Saddam Hussein and go to war against Iraq. And that turned out to be a complete fabrication. It wasn't the first time that we were lied into a war, and it wasn't the last time. We're always being told about fake enemies, whether they're communists or terrorists or weapons of mass destruction or drug traffickers. We're always being lied to get us into a war that we pay for, but which only financially rewards the shareholders of corporations that profit from war. So when George H.W. Bush says, his people have been lied to, denied the truth. Well, Americans are lied to quite a bit. We're lied to by government, we're lied to by media, and the common denominator behind those lies is the Fortune 500 that are big into deception and fabrication and myth-making. Continuing, talking about Saddam, and when his defeated legions come home, all Iraqis will see and feel the havoc he has wrought. So Bush is saying Iraqis will see and feel the havoc Saddam has wrought. How about the havoc the American military has wrought? Not due to, I'm not criticizing the military. I'm not criticizing our soldiers, our troops. I am saying that it is, you know, can we, if we were fair-minded and with an objective grasp on the truth, we would also acknowledge and recognize that havoc was wrought not primarily by Saddam, but havoc was wrought primarily by the American military. And it was done by the Department of, what department are we talking about in the federal government? The havoc was wrought by the Department of Defense, as if we are defending ourselves against somebody, as if our national interests are being protected. But our interest, it's not our interest in the sense of the majority of the American people. It's not the interests of the 99% that are being protected. It is the interest of a fraction of 1% that own the Fortune 500, the largest companies. And if we understand that we go to war not because of defense, we go to war because of lies. And if we understand that, and if enough people understand that and agitate for peace, then we will have more peace and less war. So George Bush Sr. continues with his speech from 1991 in the wake of the first Iraq War. He says, "And this I promise you, for all that Saddam has done to his own people, to the Kuwaitis and to the entire world, Saddam and those around him are accountable. Now, this is truly Orwellian. Now, when I say Orwellian, what do I mean by that? Well, in the book 1984, it's about this highly repressed and oppressed people of the future. They had this kind of propaganda machine that would say, war is peace, freedom is slavery, and ignorance is strength. So words meant the opposite. The true meaning of a word was just the opposite of the dictionary meaning. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. So when we talk about Orwellian usage of words, we're talking about words meaning the opposite of what they should mean. So Bush says, for all that Saddam has done to his own people, to the Kuwaitis, and to the entire world, Saddam and those around him are accountable. Now, what about what the U.S. government has done to our own people, and to the Iraqi people, and to the Kuwaitis, and to the entire world? Most of the world, in world opinion, here at home we say Iran's a threat to peace, North Korea is a threat to world peace, Cuba is a threat to peace, Venezuela is a threat to peace, Nicaragua is a threat to peace. We hear these things, but the world doesn't, regular people in the rest of the world don't believe this. The regular people in the rest of the world believe that the United States is the greatest threat to world peace. We spend more money on so-called defense than the entire rest of the world combined. We do so not to defend ourselves, but to prop up the fortunes of the tiny fraction of a percent represented by the wealthiest individuals. That is the purpose of our military. That is the purpose of our empire. That's the purpose of our system of taxation. And somebody might say, Hart, that sounds so radical to say that the purpose of our system of taxation, the purpose of our military, is to redistribute wealth upwards. But if you want to know the purpose of something, then look at the effect. If you want to know the purpose of something, look at the effect. Look at the end result. Look at the outcome. We have in America and in the world a widening gap between the richest people and the regular middle-class people. And part of the way that that happens is that the wealthiest individuals might be called the ownership class, the people that make their money not primarily from working, but from owning something. Not to say they don't work, but they make most of their money not from working, but from owning. And if you own stock in a major defense contractor like General Electric or Halliburton or GE or Boeing or McDonnell Douglas, then you profit from war. So you profit from war if you're part of that tiny fraction of individuals I'm calling the ownership class. You profit from war, but who pays for war? Not primarily that tiny fraction of people. Who pays for war is working people, and even upper middle class professionals are paying for war. Citizens pay for war while the ownership class profits from war. They profit from war not only because of defense, of owning stock in defense contractors, but also by owning stock in corporations that profit from war, such as multinational restaurant corporations. Think McDonald's, think Burger King, and multinational retailers. Think Home Depot, think Lowe's. These companies that once you have a small business and a medium, and it grows into a medium business, or a medium business and then it grows into a national business that grows in, once you have a national sized business, you want nothing more than to expand internationally as much as you can, and it is war that paves the way to keep those markets open for United States multinational corporations. That is, so how does that work? Well, the countries that are thought to be enemies of the United States, Iran, formerly Iraq, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, these are companies that have refused to fling their doors open wide for United States corporations. Most small third world countries, defenseless countries in the world, have learned not to oppose the U.S. economically or militarily. They know that, that you have to fit in, that the U.S. is the part of a big economic system, and you're supposed to be integrated into the United States economic system. So, for example, if you're Brazil, you might have some manufacturing, but you're not going to have manufacturing that competes head-to-head with United States manufacturing. If you're Brazil, you might have a steel industry, but not a steel industry that competes for the same type of steel as the American steel industry. Or if you're Haiti, I'm sorry, it doesn't matter that your people have been growing rice for countless generations. You're not going to compete with American rice because guess what? The laws of economics say American rice is better because it's cheaper, and we're going to flood your market with rice. Haitian rice farmers are out of business, and it's just too bad. And if you're Haiti, you might work and struggle for your independence, but you're not going to get independence because you're just too small and just not powerful enough to oppose the United States. So most countries in the world, most small third world countries in the world, have learned that lesson, unfortunately. We went to war with Iraq not once but twice because Saddam Hussein was practicing economic nationalism. He was too independent. We liked him for a while, and then all of a sudden we don't like him because he's just doing things his own way. So continuing with Bush's speech to Congress in March of 1991, all of us grieve for the victims of war, for the people of Kuwait, and the suffering that scars the soul of that proud nation. I'm sorry, this is just dripping with cynicism. All of us grieve for the victims of war. Where's the proof that George Bush or any of his compatriots grieve for the victims of war? If they grieved for the victims of war, they would avoid war. And that's why we need to downsize the military. Not only because we can't afford the military that we have, but because it's like Madeleine Albright told Colin Powell, what's the use of having this big military if you don't use it? The founding fathers knew that having a standing army was a bad thing. But for one thing, it costs a lot. For another thing, if you have all this army, you're spending money on this army, why not use it? So when you have a highly built-up military, there's every temptation in the world to use it. But we don't need that. We need to weigh down. We need to cut the military budget in half and then cut the military budget in half again. And we need to use that money, the money, the expertise, and the personnel to restore ecosystems. We need that expertise to be going into the restoration of ecosystems instead of having all that money and expertise going into death and destruction. Bush continues, we grieve for all our fallen soldiers and their families, for all the innocents caught up in this conflict. How about saying we grieve for the 120,000 Iraqis we just killed? mostly civilians. You know, that would be a realistic thing to say if we were being realistic. But this is not based on realism, it's based on fantasy. So Bush continues and he says, "And yes, we grieve for the people of Iraq, a people who have never been our enemy." Okay, Howard Zinn is a good person to quote here. Howard Zinn is a historian who wrote The People's History of the United States. He himself was a veteran of World War II, so it's not like he was a stranger to war, but he became very anti-war by the time we got to the Vietnam era. And he makes the following point. When we go to war with a tyrant, we are killing the victims of tyranny. When we go to war with Iraq, the people we are killing are themselves the victims of tyranny. Why are we killing the victims of tyranny? Is it self-defense? Are we defending anything or anybody? I would assert that we have not defended anything or anybody since 1945, because that's the last time we were involved in a war that had an element of self-defense to it. Ever since 1945, every conflict we've been involved in, we have not been the defenders, we have been the aggressors. And when we do that, when we go to war with a tyrant, we are killing the victims of that tyrant. And usually it's, you know, 10 civilians for every one soldier. For every one Iraqi soldier who dies in combat, there are 10 civilians, 10 Iraqi civilians who die in combat. So we are going to war not with the tyrant primarily, but with the victims of tyranny. In the next sentence, George H.W. Bush says, "My hope is that one day we will once again welcome them as friends into the community of nations." So one day we will once again welcome the Iraqis as friends into the community of nations. Actions are louder than words, because right after this, we had sanctions against Iraq, because Iraq, in our view, in our judgment, Iraq was not part of the community of nations, as if we get to decide unilaterally whether Iraq will be in the community of nations. As a result of those sanctions, the best estimates are that over 1 million people died and over 500,000 children died as a result of our sanctions against Iraq from the early 90s to the early 2000s, when we finally went to war with them and killed 1 million more Iraqis. In the book The Face of Imperialism by Michael Parenti, Parenti quotes William Bloom as saying the following about the war in Iraq. Both wars in Iraq, but, you know, it was like a it's like the same war that's been going on from 1991 to the present. So, you know, 25 years, every bit of it. "The people of that unhappy land have lost everything: their homes, their schools, their electricity, their clean water, their environment, their neighborhoods, their mosques, their archaeology, their jobs, their careers, their professionals, their state-run enterprises, their physical health, their mental health, their health care, their welfare state, their women's rights, their religious tolerance, their safety, their security, their children, their parents, their past, their present, their future, their lives. More than half the population is either dead, wounded, traumatized, in prison, internally displaced, or in foreign exile. The air, soil, water, blood, and genes drenched with depleted uranium and bringing the most awful birth defects. A river of blood runs alongside the Euphrates and Tigris through a country that may never be put back together again. So that's something for us to keep in mind when we think we are defending ourselves. When we think the Department of Defense is actually defense, we need to know that the Department of Defense is actually the Department of Aggression. We have not declared a legitimate war since the early 40s when we declared war against Japan, Germany, Italy, and the rest. Furthermore, this war machine is draining our resources. We're trillions of dollars in debt because of war. And we think we can't afford social programs. We think we can't afford welfare, which costs only a fraction of what the war machine costs. When some of the progressive candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talk about giving free college to students, providing free education through college, it's always, how are you going to pay for it? Well, they never ask, how are you going to pay for it when it comes to war? Because that's something that benefits the wealthiest individuals, and the wealthiest individuals own the media. The media is always pro-business because the media requires advertising dollars. Advertising dollars always come from business. So you have a media that is systematically pro-business and does not ask people how much something is going to cost when it's something that's going to benefit the very rich. So you say, Hart, you're just ranting and raving. What are we going to do about this? Okay, let's talk about what we can do about this. Think in terms of the following. Educate, organize, agitate. There is no magic formula for how that works, but you have to educate yourself and educate others. And then you have to organize. Organize means finding people in your community that think like you do and want to work toward the same ends. Get on Google, get on Facebook, find out where people are meeting in your community that care about some of the things that you care about. What we need to do in America is close the democratic deficit. The democratic deficit is the difference between between public policy and public opinion. There's a huge gap between public policy and public opinion. Most Americans want Medicare for all. Most Americans want to reduce the defense budget. Most Americans want meaningful action to be taken on climate change. And yet we're not getting that. So we need to close the democratic deficit. That means educate, organize, agitate. Educate yourself, educate others, find others in your community who think like you do, who want to work towards some of the same goals. That's organizing. And then agitate. That means protesting, writing letters, writing emails. Let your voice be heard. That is always the way democratic gains have been made, is when people agitate. That's all we have time for. Thank you for your time. Join me next time.